Welcome to South Lansing Christian Church. My name is Walter, and I'm the Young Adults and Small Groups Minister here. And it is so good to be together with you this morning, worshiping our God, whether you are out there in internet land or you're here in this room. Thanks for joining us. So have you ever felt like things were spinning out of control? That things just aren't like they used to be? Maybe if you're among the more well-seasoned generations in our congregation, like the Generation X or the Baby Boomers, you felt like things today just aren't like they used to be. Like the younger generations don't think and they don't act the way that you would expect them to, and that you're not sure what the future holds in store. Perhaps you're a younger generation in this room, and so maybe you're Generation Z or the Millennials. And some of us millennials are kind of getting up there at this point. I'm what can be referred to as a geriatric millennial. I've heard that phrase used. I'm sure it's used with love and encouragement. But if you're in one of those younger generations, maybe you've also felt like the world is spinning out of control, but for a different reason. Maybe you have anger over injustice. Maybe you feel like things are unfairly holding you back, like others are oppressing you or holding you down. All of us, no matter what generation you're in, at some point over the last year have felt some hesitancy, some unease over the state of our country, over the cracks that are forming in our political systems, right? The rivalries, the mudslingings, the conflict, the lack of civility, lack of consensus, all of that starts to make you feel like the world is spinning out of control. Well, maybe for you it's not that at all. Maybe it's not concerns over our country. Maybe it's concerns over the world in general. And so the tension and the conflict in the Middle East that continues on and on and on without any end is upsetting to you. Or maybe you've noticed the tension that's rising between the U.S. and China. Maybe none of that bothers you and you sleep like a baby at night, and congratulations to you. I'm proud of you. But how about this? Have you ever been in a place where you felt like your family was spinning out of control? It can happen in relationships when maybe a mom or dad's not getting along with each other, or maybe sisters or brothers aren't speaking to each other. It can happen in our families when we lose a loved one, with the death of a loved one. And I have seen this play out in my extended family. When a loved one passes away, those are the times when your family is at their most fragile and emotions are high and people are hurting, and then you have to do things like plan a funeral or maybe settle an estate. In those moments, your family can really feel like it's spinning out of control. Or maybe it's when there's an illness, maybe when your kid comes down with an illness. Those are the moments when things start to feel like they're not okay. I don't know what it is that you worry about, and honestly, this morning is not a therapy session, and I'm not a counselor, and that's good for all of us. But we all have moments in life where things just seem to be broken, to be kind of careening off an edge, and we feel powerless to do anything about it. And all of that is bad enough, but it gets a little bit trickier when things not only spin out of control, but then they continue to be out of control, and they just don't, nothing gets put back together. When our political parties continue to fight each other every single day, and the news just focuses our attention on it, when the illness in your family continues for days and weeks and then months, and you're not sure what the future holds, when your relationship with your spouse has been bad for so long that you find yourself considering what would it look like on the other end of this marriage. There's a word for this feeling, the feeling that things are irreversibly broken, that they can't be put back together, that you're powerless to do anything about them, and that for some reason you just can't get your focus off of them. And that word is despair. Now, maybe you wouldn't claim to be somebody who's living in despair or someone who has lived with despair, but have you ever felt in any of these ways? Have you ever felt like nothing would ever change? Have you ever felt like there was no hope of healing? Have you ever felt like the conflict that you're in will never resolve? Or have you ever felt like the work that you've been pouring your life into is not producing anything? That's despair. And if you've ever felt despair, if you've ever felt hopelessness, then you're in good company, because God's people at multiple times in their history have been in situations that have led to despair. I think of the Israelites languishing in Egypt as slaves, wondering, has God forgotten us? I think of the Israelites again during the time of the Judges, when the Midianites came and encamped on their borders, and they looked out and they saw people that were described as too numerous to count, and similar to a swarm of locusts. They were so many. I think of those same Israelites in the time of Ezekiel, the prophet that we started reading this week and that we're talking about this morning, as they looked at their nation crumbling around us. And so if you're joining us for the first time this morning, our church is in this 8-week journey through the Bible, and we would love to get a copy of the Bible version that we're reading in your hands. I saw a box of them still out at guest services. You can also follow along online. We're reading 10 to 15 pages a day, 5 days a week, and we have been on a serious journey because the prophets are a roller coaster. In Ezekiel, we read the first half last week, and so we're starting tomorrow with chapter 25. And in those first 24 chapters, you've probably picked up on the somber mood of this book. God's people in Ezekiel's time felt not only despair, but they also lived despair as they saw their homeland get ransacked and as they saw their nation crumble and their identity kind of be ripped away from them. And yet, as all of their hopes and dreams, their desires, their futures, everything that they lived for, as all of that was ripped away from them, yet God was not done. He was not done with the Israelites in Ezekiel's day, and I believe that God is also not done with us as a congregation here in South Lansing. God is not done. So let's pick up the story in Ezekiel 37 this morning. Starting in verse 1, "The Lord took hold of me, and I was carried away by the Spirit of the Lord to a valley filled with dry bones." Just imagine that for a minute. Imagine the dismay that you would feel if God brought you to a place that was just full of things that used to be human beings living and breathing and now is just decaying, decayed bones, dryness, rotting. It's just this picture of emptiness. Verse 2, "He led me all around among the bones that covered the valley floor. They were scattered everywhere across the ground and were completely dried out. And then he asked me, 'Son of man, can these bones become living people again?' 'O sovereign Lord,' I replied, 'you alone know the answer to that.'" Let's just take a step back and talk about what's going on in Ezekiel. Because if you've been reading with us, again, you've noticed that the prophets are a little bit difficult to understand if you don't pick up on the broader context. And so as we've been reading the prophets, they're not actually in our immersed prophet books. It's the text of the New Living Translation, but it's arranged differently than you would historically find the books of the Bible arranged. And so unlike this Bible and a normal Bible canon, the prophets are arranged more chronologically to when they would have spoke to the Israelite people in our immersed books. And so we started reading with a few: Amos, Isaiah, Micah, Hosea, and they warned the northern kingdom, Israel, that God was unhappy with them, that they were breaking God's laws, and that destruction was coming. And then we read another group of prophets who spoke after that northern kingdom fell in 722 BC, and they warned that the southern kingdom, Judah, was going to face the same thing if they too didn't turn from their wicked ways. And those prophets were Zephaniah and Nahum and Habakkuk. And now we're reading Jeremiah and Obadiah and Ezekiel. And these are all prophets who prophesied around the time that southern kingdom, that Judah, was besieged by the Babylonians and then fell. And typically we date the fall of the southern kingdom to 586, and we pick a specific year for when it fell. But it was a process. And so before 586, the Babylonians showed up and they captured a bunch of the people of Judah and they took them back to the city of Babylon and they installed their own little puppet monarch in Babylon or in Jerusalem. And then over the next few years, the people in Judah rebelled against the Babylonians again. And so that's how you have Ezekiel sitting in Babylon looking at his people who lived in Jerusalem and having these visions from afar. And to say that Ezekiel's visions are disheartening is really an understatement. Because he has visions of Israel's leaders back in Jerusalem entering the temple, which is the place where God dwelt with his people and he met with them. And yet Israel's leaders were going in and they were setting up false gods and they were bowing down to them in God's space. And so Ezekiel warns that, man, God is so done with you guys. He's unhappy with this. Your nation is going to be overthrown and that the people in Judah were going to live in destitute conditions. And then in chapter 11, Ezekiel has another vision. And it's even more disheartening than just seeing the nation of Judah being overthrown and destroyed. It's that God's presence literally rose up above the temple, rose up above the city of Jerusalem, and departed from the land. It was an incredibly vivid picture of a God who was dwelling with a specific people, choosing to no longer dwell with them. Imagine for a moment that feeling that God was done with you, that he was taking off, and that you were left behind. That's the feeling that Ezekiel had when he spoke these words, and that was what he was conveying, that he was telling to the people back in Judah. It's terrifying. And then in chapter 33, a couple chapters before where we're picking up the story today, Ezekiel gets word that all of the visions, all of the things that he had been seeing concerning the Israelites back in Jerusalem and in Judah had come to pass, and that the Babylonians had showed up, and that they had knocked down the walls, and that they had leveled the city of Jerusalem, and that the temple was no more. And so again, put yourself in Ezekiel's shoes. As an Israelite, your entire identity was wrapped up in being God's chosen people. You had a specific purpose. You had a specific place, the promised land. You had a unique legal agreement with God, which was your covenant. Your purpose was to be set apart, to show the world what it looked like to be God's holy people. And then, knowing all of that, you were carried off to some foreign land. You became captive in a foreign city, and while there, you watched every part of your identity be chipped away piece by piece, as your nation was ransacked and finally demolished and destroyed by a foreign power, and as your countrymen broke their agreement with God. And then eventually, as God himself rose up out of your land, out of your nation, and took off. It makes sense then that one of those exiles sitting in Babylon during this time wrote these words in Psalm 137. Beside the rivers of Babylon, we sat and we wept as we thought of Jerusalem. We put away our harps, hanging them on branches of poplar trees. For our captors demanded a song from us. Our tormentors insisted on a joyful hymn. Sing us one of those songs of Jerusalem. But how can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a pagan land? Back here in Ezekiel 37, God brings a prophet to this valley of dry bones. And as Ezekiel, after having endured all of that desolation, after seeing his hopes and his dreams smashed, after losing his homeland and to a great extent his identity, he knows one thing, and that is despair. Just listen to these words in Ezekiel 37 again, verse 11. Then he said to me, "Son of man, these bones represent the people of Israel. They are saying, 'We have become old, dry bones. All hope is gone. Our nation is finished.'" Do you hear the despair in there? Do you hear the phrases, "All hope is gone, our nation is finished, our people are no more, our purpose as God's chosen is done"? But the thing is, the story didn't end in verse 11. And even in this darkest of dark moments, God was not done with the people of Israel. And so we continue reading in verse 12. "Therefore, prophesy to them and say, 'This is what the sovereign Lord says, O my people, I will open your graves of exile and cause you to rise again, and then I will bring you back to the land of Israel. When this happens, O my people, you will know that I am the Lord.'" You see, God was not done with the Israelites. He still had a purpose for them. He still had work for them to do. And that's why I believe that the book of Ezekiel teaches us this, that even in our darkest moments when things seem hopeless, when we feel dismay and despair, even then, God is not done. God was certainly not done with the Israelites in Ezekiel's day, and he is not done here in South Lansing. And so, because of that, because that you and I worship a God who continues on, who is constantly at work, because we worship a God like that, we've got work to do. One of the songs that we're going to sing in response this morning includes phrases like "waymaker" and "promise keeper," that God continues to work, that he never stops working. And when things are good, God is there and he's active and he's with us. And when things are impossibly bad and impossibly dark, God is still with us in those moments. Even when our world seems to be careening out of control, God is not done with us. He's not done with our family. He's not done with our church. And he's not done in this world. And if that's the case, if God is truly active, then that means that you and I have work to do. God is not done, and there's work to do. And so what are you going to do about it? God is not done. He's not done with our kids. And so back in Kid City, we have young, early kids who are just like the earliest Christ followers, and they need to know Jesus. They need you to help write the next chapter of their faith story. They need you to be part of that. Back in Kid City, back in the flood, back in Modified, our high school ministry, research tells us that it takes seven caring adults in a congregation to help students have the best chance of becoming fully committed followers of Jesus. And those adults don't include their youth minister, and they don't include volunteers in their youth group. That's just adults in their congregation who are checking in with them and who are supporting them and helping them figure out what it means to be a Christ follower, and adults who are investing in them. We need you to step up and to be involved in our kids' ministry, to be involved in our middle school ministry, to be involved in our high school ministry. God is not done with our kids. God is not done with your marriage. You know, when couples come to therapy, often one of the first things that they learn is that it only takes one person to start change in a relationship. It only takes one person taking positive steps to really make a difference in a marriage. And so whether you're in crisis or maybe your marriage is just okay, God is not done in your marriage, and he's calling you to invest in your spouse. What can you do this week to recognize God's work in your marriage and to continue that relationship, to bless your husband or your wife? God is not done in your neighborhood, and he's certainly not done with your neighbors. And as a follower of Jesus, you don't get to come home and be a hermit in your own house. Who in your neighborhood needs their gutters cleaned and their leaves raked before winter? Who's not ready in their yard or with their house for cold and snow to arrive? Because it's on its way, as we all have found out this morning. Who in your neighborhood needs to be invited into community with your family? Who needs to be invited into your small group? Who in your neighborhood needs to know that Jesus is alive and that we serve a risen Savior and that they need a relationship with them? God is not done in your neighborhood, so set aside your need for anonymity, set aside your frustrations and your tensions with those around you, and get to work. God is not done in our city. The data that we have from a couple years ago that says that within a 3-mile radius of our church building, 36% of the people are not involved in faith. And so that's 21,421 people in 2016 who were not part of any faith community. I can only imagine that number has gone up. Additionally, according to Data USA, young women between 18 and 24 are the demographic in the greater Lansing area most likely to be living in poverty, followed closely by young men ages 18 to 24. And so in the greater Lansing area in 2019, there were 24,000 of these young adults living in poverty. WILX reported in October that 2021 marks the most homicides that our city has seen in the last 20 years. And trends like these, thousands living in poverty, rising violence, thousands far from God, they can do one of two things. They can make us sit back, try to escape the violence, try to escape the chaos, keep our heads down, be concerned about the hopelessness of the situation, but do nothing about it. Or they can make us step up. I believe that God is not done in our city. And because he's not done in our city, what are you going to do about it? God is not done at our church. South Lansing Christian Church's 70th birthday is just around the corner. And, you know, for most people, you're approaching your 88th decade, and you might want to take it back, take it easy a little bit, take a step back, take care of yourself. But our church is not doing that. Our church is just getting started. We believe that God has so much more to write to our story here in South Lansing. We're not slowing down. And so God is at work here. He's at work in our kids' ministry, and we need you to step up and make a difference. God is at work with our students, with our high schoolers, with our middle schoolers, and we need you to step up and mentor some of them. God is at work in our young adults, and they need to know a more mature Christ follower who's a little farther down the road who can give them some perspective. God is at work in our small groups, and we need you to step up and become a small group leader and invite people into community. God is at work here among us on Sunday mornings, and you can be part of that. We need you. God is at work in our outreach as a church, as we go out and we be the hands and the feet of Jesus in our community, representing God's message and God's love to Greater Lansing, to a place that desperately needs to know him. You're not too young. You're not too old. You're not too uneducated, too overeducated, too important, too unimportant to sit this one out. You don't get to graduate. You don't get to retire from serving God. God's not done here, and so neither are you. In 2019, Jamie and I got to visit our friends who live in Myanmar. Their names are Johnny and Janelle, and we've been friends with them for quite a while, since grad school. When we were in grad school, we noticed that our friends were just, they were singularly focused on this one goal, and that was following the call of the Great Commission and to going into all the world and spreading the gospel to all nations. And so Johnny and Janelle, when we knew them in grad school, they sold all of their stuff, their house. It was kind of crazy. And then the remainder of their possessions, they packed up in this tiny little funky RV, and they traveled around the Midwest, and they raised support. And then they spent a significant amount of time learning the Burmese language, which is incredibly difficult for non-Burmese speakers to learn, and especially for people who speak English. And then they got on an airplane with their infant son, and they flew and they landed in Yangon, the capital city, with very few connections there at all. And so from that point forward, they embedded themselves deeply in the community there. They got to know their neighbors. They started building this NGO, non-governmental organization, that was devoted to raising people up out of poverty, and simultaneously devoted to training ministers to support themselves so that they could go out and preach and teach to their people. And over the next few years, Johnny and Janelle, over the next decade really, they invested their lives, their money, their time, their family, pretty much everything that they had, into training up and raising ministers who would spread the gospel. And then, if you remember, at the beginning of 2021, the news came out that the country of Myanmar had been taken over in a military coup, as the military stepped in and deposed a sitting state councilor, which is basically their prime minister. And following that, they instituted authoritarian, they instituted martial law, and tanks ended up in Johnny and Janelle's neighborhood, and bullets were fired into their office place. And so then our friends had to flee. They had to evacuate the city and come back to America. And imagine for just a moment if everything you've poured your life into for the last decade suddenly went up in flames with the very real threat of violence around you. That's the situation that our friends found themselves in. As they arrived back in America, they were shell-shocked, they were heartbroken, they felt powerless to fix the situation, and honestly, they felt guilty at leaving their friends, the Burmese people, behind to face that violence while they could escape to somewhere safe. It was a moment that could have led to despair, and honestly, Johnny and Janelle had a lot of time, they spent a lot of time working through that because those feelings were deep and the hurt was real. And yet, God was not done with the country of Myanmar. Since February, the military has cut ties with nearly every organization, corporation, any entity that was not of Burmese origin. Almost every, that is, except for our friend's little NGO. And so by the grace of God, Johnny can hop online and video chat at midnight for us, because Myanmar is 11 and a half hours off from our time zone. And he can chat with his staff of 20 or so in the city of Yangon, and they can continue the work that Johnny and Janelle and that God started through them. No one can say when the country might open up again, and no one knows whether Johnny and Janelle will ever be able to return to Myanmar. It's impossible to know if the military is going to relinquish control. But none of that matters to God, because he's not bound by national or international borders, and our human conflicts are not things that have power over him. He does not stop in the middle of a crisis. God is at work in Myanmar, and just in the same way he's at work here in South Lansing. As you finish reading Ezekiel this week, you're going to note that he spends the last 8 chapters describing the temple in extremely, extremely fine detail. And I spoke with more than one person this week who was a little confused, if not annoyed by it, because for us, that reading is kind of boring. And that's okay. But if you were an exile living in Babylon and you had heard Ezekiel's vision of God's presence rising up over your city and leaving you, to hear that God once again wanted to come back and live with you again would have been life-giving in an incredible way. And so to have God spend 8 chapters of Ezekiel explaining what that new temple was going to look like would have been so empowering. And in fact, I think one of the most powerful moments is at the very end of Ezekiel, the very final, the very last sentence, when the prophet says this. He's talking about the rebuilding of Jerusalem and the new temple. And he says this, "And from that day, the name of the city will be, the Lord is there." This is this message of hope to these exiles in a foreign land, in a distant land, far from home, that God was not done. God is not done today. No matter how out of control our world feels at any given moment, God is not done. And because of that, there is plenty to do. Years later, Jesus came on the scene, and he said this to his followers in Matthew 9. He said, "The harvest is great, but the workers are few. So pray to the Lord who is in charge of the harvest and ask him to send more workers into his field." The harvest is plentiful, and God is not done here, and we need you. Would you pray with me this morning? Father, we thank you for the message that you've given us through Ezekiel and the words that he spoke to the Israelites. God, there are moments in which we feel dismay, we feel disheartened. God, we feel hopeless. Sometimes, God, the future to us just seems clouded or it seems impossible, and yet we know, God, that throughout human history that you are good and that you've been working a plan. Father, I thank you that our story stretches back thousands of years and that it continues on into eternity. And that, Father, we get to look forward to living forever with you in the new heaven and the new earth. God, I pray that as we go out today from this place that you would motivate us to step up, to recognize and to see the places in which you're working in our lives, in our city, in our church. And God, that we would feel invited motivated to be involved and to be engaged in those spaces as well. Jesus, it's in your name that we pray these things this morning. Amen. In just a moment, we're going to have a time to respond and worship. And one of the things that we do here at South is every week we share in the Lord's Supper together. It's this reminder, you can find it on the tables in the back, that the juice represents that Jesus' blood was spilled. It was poured out for you and for me, and that and the bread, the little chiclet, reminds us that Jesus' body was broken. It was broken because God sent Jesus to live this perfect, sinless life, to dwell among us, to be among his people again. And then Jesus laid down that life, God raised him from the dead. And so when we celebrate communion together, that's what we remember. We remember Jesus' sacrifice and the hope that we have as followers. And so would you stand and sing with me this morning as we worship God and as we take communion together?